This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
So, welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and the big picture. Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here with you. The stock market, if you've been watching it, has been slowly grinding upward. And another record week for the Dow. The major indexes are in record territory. And all of this is occurring at a time when inflation is slowing down. Economic growth has weakened. The Fed has raised interest rates, which of course brings us now to a question. With stocks at an all-time high, what happens in the final months of the year, which have traditionally been strong for the stock market? And I guess the summary of this is, are investors in for another double-digit return in the stock market this year?
You know, John, if you look at 2016, which turned out to be a fairly good year for stocks with double-digit returns in the market, slightly over 10%. But if you think about it, all the way up to the election, it was really a mediocre year. Stocks were only up about 4 or 5%. And then, of course, we got that Trump rally that took place after he was elected because the markets were thinking, as Frank and I talked about in the first hour, all these great things were going to happen. Infrastructure, tax cuts, repeal of Obamacare, defense spending, all of this stimulus that was coming in the market. The only stimulus that we've gotten so far has been on the deregulation front. So if you look at Q4 last year, it was really unusual in that most of the gains took place in probably the last 7 weeks of the year. So things did do well, and it was a double-digit year for the market. But most of those gains, John, came in the last couple months of the year. And a lot of that took place with energy. The performance of energy, which did well and was one of the best performing sectors for 2016, had a lot to do with the price of oil. Because remember, we got down to $26 a barrel in February. And then by the end of the year, we were trucking towards $55 a barrel. And that was doing a number of things. Number one, it was the impetus behind the rise in energy stocks. And secondly, with Donald Trump wanting to deregulate the industry, that also fueled speculation in energy. And then the other thing it was given rise to was inflation. So inflation was starting to come up towards the Fed's target of 2%. And of course, now that energy has fallen back, it's no surprise that inflation is on the downside. So much of the rise that we've seen in inflation and what happened to the stock market last year and this year was directly related to the price of oil.
Turning to inflation, the 12-month change in the price index for personal consumption expenditures was 1.7% in April, up from less than 1% last summer, but down somewhat over the past few months. Core inflation, which excludes the volatile food and energy categories and tends to be a better indicator of future inflation, has also edged lower. The recent lower readings on inflation have been driven significantly by what appear to be one-off reductions in certain categories of prices, such as wireless telephone services and prescription drugs. These price declines will, as a matter of arithmetic, restrain the 12-month inflation figures until the extraordinarily low March reading drops out of the calculation. However, with employment near its maximum sustainable level and the labor market continuing to strengthen, the committee still expects inflation to move up and stabilize around 2% over the next couple of years, in line with our longer-run objective. Nonetheless, in light of the softer recent inflation readings, the committee is monitoring inflation developments closely.
All right, that was obviously Fed Chair Janet Yellen after the announcement of the last rate hike. She's talking about inflation falling short of expectations there. Now, how much of that is correlated to what we see in the price of oil, which has come down since the beginning of the year?
Oh, it has a lot to do with it. In fact, there were a lot of analysts in the first quarter that were talking about that inflation would peak, which is exactly what has happened, because it peaked in the first quarter, and we've seen a downturn in the rate of inflation, which she just referred to there. But like any forecast that doesn't come to fore, you always see the Fed, well, we think these are temporary things. You know what, Janet? What happens if these things are more temporary than you think they are? So the real key here, John, is going to be what happens with the reflation trade, because we typically get it in the fourth quarter. If you take, let's say, the last six out of the last 8 years, we've seen an inflation trade that usually takes place in the market in Q4, usually starting at the end of October and running to the end of the year. Very strong performance in things like energy, industrial stocks, material stocks, which were some of the big winners as we got into the end of, November and December of last year. But we are seeing a bubble develop in the market, as Frank and I talked about, because what is sort of deceiving about this stock market is, Frank and I talked about in hour one, a good portion of the index's gains, because the indexes are market weighted, meaning the stocks, they have the largest capitalization, carry more weight in terms of what happens to the index. So you can see the index reaching new records, but a lot of stocks aren't participating. So we see a bubble developing in the FANG stocks being driven by what I call passive investing, with all that money that's going into the index funds. And you want to get more into that. We did a show on this about a month ago that got into, for example, you put money in the Qs, every $100 million that goes into the Qs, about $12 million out of the $100 million is going to go into Amazon, which is why we're seeing some of these valuations. So the real key thing that we are watching now is what happens with this reflation trade. And if we don't see a reflation trade, it would indicate some of the things that Frank was talking about in hour one, that we're probably getting closer to a top. So we're sort of right now, John, we're sort of caught in between inflation and deflation. We have neither, and it can go in either direction.
So if we take the arguments for reflation heading into the end of the year, how would they stack up?
Well, I mean, if we take a look at what is positive on the reflation side, the yield curve is positive for stocks, meaning that longer-term rates are above short-term rates. When the yield curve inverts, meaning short-term rates are higher than long-term rates, which is usually comes about as a result of Fed rate hikes, because they affect the short end more than the long end. So that is still good for stocks. The other thing, even though there is questions now whether Trump will get his agenda through, there are some things that are coming down the line, at least they're talking about them, that could be a stimulus on the inflation front. One of them would be tax cuts. Second would be infrastructure spending. And also, for example, if the Saudi oil cuts or production cuts in OPEC don't work, would be additional cuts coming, and they would probably have to come mainly from Saudi Arabia, which could drive the price of oil up. The other thing that's still positive is corporate earnings are doing rather well. It was a good, strong first quarter, and it's expected as the second quarter ends, corporate earnings will be up as well.
So if we were to argue, say, for example, deflation negatives, one that really pops to mind immediately is the Fed's raising interest rates. That should have some impact on this.
Well, I mean, yeah, sure. I mean, and more importantly, it's not just that they're going to be raising interest rates. If, you know, it's still a question whether they go for the third time in December. A lot will depend on this reflation efforts and what happens to the global economy as well as the economy here. But also, there's a possibility that OPEC can't control the price of oil, that actually it collapses. It stays in the low 40s where it is now, or even goes down into the 30s. The other thing that we have, John, is we have the inclusion now of geopolitical risk, Brexit. We also have the congressional midterm elections that'll come up next year. And you know what it's like when we get into silly season. There is going to be a full bore campaign that's going to begin at the beginning of next year. And it's going to be all out war, because the Democrats would like to retake Congress back. And then, of course, we also have the risk within the Trump administration and Washington itself of political inertia. There's division within the Republican Party, and the Democrats have no intention of cooperating with the president or Republicans on anything in the hopes of recapturing Congress in the midterm elections, November of next year.
So right now, if we look at it, we have a weakening economy. I know you and Frank talked about receding credit. The bond market seems to be hinting more at deflation and a slowdown rather than reflation.
Well, I mean, you take a look at, and I think the bond market guys tend to get it right more often than the stock market does. Right now, you've got a stock market with the FANG stocks that are becoming more like the Nifty 50 stocks that Frank and I talked about in hour one. I mean, all you have to do, if you have any charting software and you can put on multiple, let's say, stocks or an index on a chart, put a chart of the S&P on a chart, just a one-year chart, and then put a chart of Microsoft, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google on top of it. Literally, John, it looks like a NASA space launch compared to a turtle that's just kind of cruising along. So the index funds are fueling the bubble, and that's why you've got this divergence right now between the stock market and the bond market, and only one of these are lined up.
You know, Frank Barbera, just returning to the program after a long hiatus, he's one of the first techs of all the techs we've had on that's a little more cautionary than most. Although Robin Griffith said the stock market, he believes, is good for another month, probably at least July or whatever, but be wary as you slide into the fall.
Yeah, I mean, right now we're seeing these FANG stocks, or we call them the Fab Six now, because there's more than just four. Got to throw Tesla in there, and you got to throw a few others, some of the big tech stocks, a Microsoft in there. So what you're looking for, usually if we're going to get this reflation trade, I think oil's going to be a key part of that. We'll cover oil in the next segment. But watch what's happening to business tech, materials, and industrials. Because if we are going to get a reflationary effort, this is what has been leading in every fourth quarter that we've seen the reflation trade for the last 6 years, just like it was last year. So if we see those start to take off, if oil prices start to rise, that would give a lot more confidence in, let's say, what's happening or what might happen on this reflation trade. Because you have to think about what is going to be the driver as we get into the third quarter and fourth quarter. It certainly isn't going to be the Federal Reserve. It certainly isn't going to be economic growth. Although the one good thing about lower oil prices and gasoline prices, but we'll get into some of the negatives about that as well, is, John, in many ways, that's a stimulus. If the price of gasoline drops 25, 30 cents a gallon, for a lot of Americans, that's a big stimulus. That's equivalent to billions of dollars injected into consumers' pocketbooks.
Well, you and Frank were talking about the bond market divergence here, and it looks like the bond market may actually have it more right than the stock market, which seems to be driven by this sort of heavy loading on tech stocks.
Well, you know, we follow the credit markets and we follow the bond markets because usually that gives us a heads up, especially when we start seeing widening credit spreads. We know that trouble lies ahead. The one thing that, if you take a look at what you would need, we need for this reflation trade, we need to see interest rates begin to rise. Why? What does that do? The difference when interest rates start to rise, especially on the long end, what that does is it creates a larger spread for banks to lend money. So, for example, last year, towards the end, when we thought that interest rates were going to rise with the Fed leaning towards raising interest rates in December, which they did, you saw the financial stocks start to take off, and you saw that happen in the first quarter where financials were doing well. So that would tell you that the inflation trade was in play in the risk-on trade. However, if you see interest rates begin to fall, as they have here recently, what do you see? The financial stocks are weak, and the utility index is stronger, intimating more that you're heading more towards a deflation trade. So you're looking at the utility index. So we also have this kind of different market that's developing in itself. You're seeing utilities hit an all-time record at the same time that you're seeing NASDAQ stocks and the FANG stocks hitting all-time records. So lower interest rates is not really a good thing for the reflation trade, and you're seeing that reflected right now in what's happening to utilities versus, bank stocks.
Well, Jim, you know, you're talking about falling interest rates, but we've also discussed the idea that the Fed is starting to shrink its balance sheet. Now, couldn't that cause some kind of inflationary pressures, because then you've got more buyers coming into the market?
You know, when I look at that, if the Fed wanted to raise long-term interest rates, shrinking their balance sheet may be another tool of doing that. What that means is the Fed rolls over less and less. That means there's less buying power coming into the market, which could force interest rates up. So that is a possibility. But right now, this recovery since 2009 has been based on 0% interest rates, cheap credit, and an ocean of liquidity. So on the one hand, they could be raising interest rates. That would be good for financial stocks, and especially if banks began to lend more freely if they did that. But also, it's withdrawing liquidity from the market. And whenever you draw with liquidity, eventually, that liquidity means there's less buying pressure coming into the market, and you start to see stocks stall. So it's both good and bad.
So getting back to the reflation side, if this were to turn, what would be some of the things that you might be watching?
Well, I mean, the first thing that could happen is if they actually get some tax cuts, because what would that do? Right now, the tax rate's 35%. So if a company made $100, $35 would go to taxes. They would have $65 left over. Now, what happens if they lower the tax rates on corporations to 20% or 15%, depending on whose plan gets accepted? So on $100, instead of paying $35, a company would pay $20, which means another $15 would go to the bottom line. That could raise corporate earnings by $6 or $7. Another thing that they're talking about is repatriation. There's over $2 trillion resting overseas that has not come home because it wants to avoid that 35% tax. So they could do, for example, a one-time special tax of 5 to 10%. You bring it home, you reinvest it, whether you know companies could use that to increase dividends, buy back stock, buy other companies, or invest in plant and equipment. That could be a stimulus. So taxes are definitely high on the list. Low gasoline prices, as I mentioned, are also another form of stimulus. That puts money in a lot of consumers. A 20, 25 cent drop in a gallon of gasoline may not sound like much, but you know, maybe you have a big car and you're putting in 20 gallons a week, and all of a sudden gas drops by a couple bucks or 25 cents. That's a lot of money. That's an extra 10, 20 bucks of spending power in your wallet. And then there's only one negative to that, John. Can you guess what that is?
Well, no.
Governments are using the drop in gasoline prices to raise gasoline taxes. California just raised gas taxes 20 cents. I think we're now about 59 cents a gallon. And there's been like 10 states now are using this opportunity. Rather than to let that money flow directly into consumer pocketbooks, they're using it to raise taxes so it flows directly into government.
So right now, those are the positives, but you know, the Fed is determined to go forward with what it's doing with both of its balance sheet and for rate raising. Nevertheless, with the idea that they do stuff or they adjust things until something breaks, they may have to backtrack if things don't play out as they expected, just like is happening with their inflation forecast. And we're always remembering that the Fed almost always seems to get its forecasts wrong.
I know. And they may be learning a little bit of a lesson. If you listen to the press conferences that come out of the FOMC meeting, they're saying, well, they're not saying data dependent, but they're saying, hey, if things go along like we think they're going along, they seem to be going or hedging themselves a little bit because they know they don't have the chamber loaded up. And they know sooner or later we are going to have another recession. They know the business cycles don't last forever and we're going to have a bear market. So what are they going to use? And the last thing that they want is to see economic growth weaken overseas. One of the reasons you've seen a weaker dollar is that economic growth overseas has picked up substantially, which has helped to keep the dollar down. What they don't want to see is economic growth weaken overseas. They're raising interest rates, and there's such a wide disparity between what we have here in U.S. interest rates compared to Europe. Like I said, even on this Friday, where we're down to about almost 2.14%, you know, in Germany, it's like 27 basis points. So, you know, we're almost 8 times higher than what you're seeing in Europe today. So we're still the best place to invest. But if economic growth was to weaken overseas, weaken over here, and the Fed's raising interest rates, you would see the dollar rise. A rising dollar would also bring down their inflation targets.
Okay, well, if we put all this together, what does it boil down to?
Boy, John, it's going to get down to two things. It's the price of oil or stimulus. because those are only two things that are going to drive the inflation trade as we head into the fourth quarter. If we get oil prices start to tighten, get back up into the 50 range, or the Republicans push through a tax cut and some kind of infrastructure spending. Because remember, next year is the midterm elections. Imagine if you're a Republican running for re-election. You've been claiming for 7 or 8 years, gosh, we didn't have the presidency, we didn't have Congress. Well, you got both houses of Congress, now you have the presidency. If you don't repeal Obamacare, if you don't lower taxes, if you don't do anything on infrastructure, John, it could be a disaster at the polls next November, because you know what the other party's going to do and say, look at these guys, they can't do anything. You know, vote for us in. So it gets down to oil and it gets down to stimulus coming from the government. That's what it's going to be down to.
Well, what about OPEC? I mean, what if they get to the point where the production cuts, they perceive them to say they're not enough, they should consider further cuts? Remember what happened last November, where something very similar happened.
Well, I mean, that is one possibility, because I think they've been surprised, and we'll get more into detail in the next topic on oil. But there's just too many things that have to go right now. Inventories are falling. That's a good sign. But also production is increasing, and also you have production coming online with some members of OPEC that were left out of these production cuts, and that's Libya and Nigeria, and we'll talk about that in the next segment. So these markets right now, John, are being driven by politics and liquidity, and therein lies the real risk going forward. It could be if oil doesn't firm and drops, there goes your reflation trade. Number two, the Fed pushes rates too far. And three, Washington gets bogged down and can't get stimulus done. This market, you need to be thinking of hedging and de-risking, as Frank and I talked about in the first hour, because there are a lot of things that have to go right for this thing to continue, especially into the end of the year.
Well, let's face it. Ever since the election of President Trump, the never-Trumpers and the media, who are part of that, the agenda is to stop President Trump from, and I would guess as a subsidiary, the Republican Congress, from accomplishing anything. So if Republicans don't get anything done, there's going to be heck to pay at the polls next year as far as their constituents are concerned. But there are some more complex things involved there as well because of the negative reaction to the negative reaction.
Yeah, like I said, this market is being driven by politics and liquidity. If you take a look at the market rally on the Trump election, a lot of that, as Frank and I talked about, was based on certain things happening. And not one of them has happened. Now, the president has moved on the regulatory front in freeing up a lot of these strangling regulations, especially in energy area. But, you know, that isn't enough to turn around this economy if we begin to slow down. So we haven't repealed Obamacare, although there's a bill that was introduced in the Senate. But there are five Republicans that are saying they can't favor it. So there's going to have to be a lot of horse trading, but they better start getting something done, because if they don't, there's going to be a political fallout that results of this, and it won't be long before the market sniffs this out, well before it happens, and maybe that's what it's doing right now.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour, featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
When I speak about imperial decline, of course, it's easy to speak of the U.S. as the empire of the moment, because we have been the most overwhelmingly powerful nation in terms of the size of our economy, our military force, and so on. In that sense, the U.S. has parallels, right, with any of the dominant nation states in the past. Whether you want to call them an empire or not, that's a choice. But I also think we're talking about a larger empire. I mean, this is not my phrase. Other people have used it, the empire of debt. And in that sense, we're really talking about the majority of the nation states and the global economy. That includes China, which is incredibly debt dependent, most of the West, Japan, much of Southeast Asia, and so on. So what we're really talking about is the vulnerabilities and fragilities that arise once you become debt dependent. In other words, you're having to borrow $10 to get a dollar of economic growth, which is where the world is right now.
Well, despite the Fed raising interest rates for the third time in 3 months, interest rates have stayed moderated. Joining us on the program from PFS Group is Rob Bernard. Rob, what's going on with interest rates? You know, the Fed has raised interest rates now, what, 3 times in almost 6 months. And yet on the day they raised interest rates, the 10-year note dropped down to 2.1. So what's keeping rates this low on the long end?
Well, Jim, I think it's interesting, but the old adage is never fight the Fed, but it makes people wonder. Now the Fed funds rate is 1.25%, and the Fed also gave a roadmap on how to unwind the $4.5 trillion balance sheet. But in my opinion, the only justification for the rate increase at the present is the Fed feels the necessity to drain excess liquidity from the massive quantitative easing and return monetary policy to some sort of normality. And then, of course, reload the Fed's tool bag. The goal of 2% inflation seems to be still absent by the Fed's own admission, and I don't think it's going to show up for maybe 12 months or more. And still, the Fed is on track for one more rate hike this year. And if you look at the dot plot chart, they seem to be still very aggressive for 2018.
Yeah, it's amazing, too, because if you take a look at their inflation targets are below expected. The economy has certainly slowed down. It's growing at 2%, so you can't see it's heating up. Rob, how much of this has to do with the spread between interest rates here, where the 10-year Treasury on the day we're doing this is at a little over 2.15? But, you know, I look at a 10-year Treasury note in Germany, and it's 0.25%. So how much of that is the spread difference between, let's say, sovereign yields around the globe?
I think a lot of it is, Jim, because we're the best house in town to park money at. Look at the United Kingdom, 1%. France is at 0.59. Would you give your money to the French guys for 10 years and make 0.59%? Italy is 1.88, and Japan's going to give you 0.044%. So no wonder why we have constant flows into the United States in our treasury market. And you're right, 2.156 today as we speak. That's fantastic for borrowers, not so good for savers.
So as you look at this situation we're in, the Fed, with this meeting saying, hey, we're still going to go one more time, and the fact that they're going to be shrinking their balance sheet, it's another form of tightening because they're withdrawing liquidity in the market. And especially as they start doing that with mortgages, Rob, how do you play this kind of market? Because there is the risk, even though interest rates have moderated because of spreads, but if, let's say, the deficits start to get larger with, let's say, tax cuts or infrastructure spending, or inflation does start to heat up, how does one play this kind of bond market? Because we know eventually, as the Fed raises interest rates, they usually do it until they crash land the airplane. I've yet, you know, outside a few exceptions, I have yet to see them basically raise interest rates without doing damage somewhere, either to the markets or the economy, and sometimes both.
Well, that's correct. Historically, rising interest rates tend to put downward pressure on bond prices. And of course, that's unless you own short maturities or floating rate bonds. Short maturities do not offer a very appealing coupon at the present, so that leaves the floating rate bonds. And what we do is look for these bonds out in the marketplace and buy them. And a lot of times we have a potential for total return, because as a floating rate bond gets near its floating rate term, when it starts, the bond usually falls because most of them have 5 or 6% coupons when they first came out when interest rates were higher. Anyway, so the bond winds up trading at a bit of a discount to par value. And as the Federal Reserve continues to push interest rates up and the bonds go into their floating regime, the interest rate goes up on the bond every 3 months. And bingo, over a period of maybe 6 months or so, your bond goes back up to par value. So you get the coupon plus the capital appreciation in your bond.
Can you sort of explain or give an example, a hypothetical example of what that might look like? I mean, I'm sure most of our listeners are familiar with what we call variable rate mortgages or adjustable rate mortgages that go up and down depending on what's happening with interest rates by the Fed. But explain, for example, how an adjustable rate or floating rate bond works.
Well, for illustration purposes, all bond examples are from fictitious companies that I'm going to talk about. Anacott Steel.
Oh, remember that one from Wall Street Week. Is that Blue Horseshoe?
Yeah, Blue Horseshoe's buddy. But anyway, let's use that as an example. It's a fictitious company. Anacott Steel, let's say it has a coupon of 5%, is currently trading at par value, which is $1,000 a bond. The bond will enter its floating period in 3 months. The bond will float and adjust quarterly at its assigned margin plus the then current 3 month LIBOR rate. Today's 3 month LIBOR rate is 1.28%. The bond's margin is 3%. Add the two together and the new coupon rate is 4.28%. Because the coupon rate has dropped from 5 to 4.28%, the bond now trades at a discount of, say, $97 or $970 per bond. As the Federal Reserve continues to raise the Fed funds rate, the potential capital gain comes into play. Theoretically, with 3 rate hikes of 25 basis points, the bond could be back at a 5% coupon. The value may be back up or near par, which is the $1,000 a bond. With additional rate hikes, it's possible the bond could actually trade at a premium.
Let me throw this out. So the Fed is in a rate raising mode. So if you own a floating rate bond, as the Fed raises interest rates, the interest rate on the bond goes up, so the investor gets more money. Now, let's flip this. And let's just say that the Fed continues to raise interest rates, but sometime, I don't know when it is, they raise rates enough in 2018 because they're projecting 3 more rate hikes. Or let's say 2019, we're in a recession. And Rob, we know what happens in a recession. In a recession, the Fed goes in the reverse direction. So what happens to these bonds when that happens, when the Fed starts lowering interest rates?
That's when you sell the bonds because they're going to float back down again and you buy fixed coupon bonds and you have a potential profit right there. As rates decline, you fixed your rate at a higher rate at the time and therefore that's the way you want to play this.
Is there any other strategy to use given this uncertainty? Because, I mean, there are a couple things that have happened. At the beginning of the year, if you looked at Wall Street strategists, they were predicting that the 10-year note would be at 3% given what the Fed was planning. When the Fed came out in December, then they said, oh, by the way, we're changing our mind and we're actually raising the number of times we're going to raise interest rates. So people were expecting that the long end of the bond would be at 3%. As you and I are talking, it's closer to 2%. So what other strategies would you employ here, or would you stick with interest rate floating bonds because of the outlook of more rate hikes, number one, and number two, we don't know how this bond market's going to play out?
Well, if you're a long-term investor, I would still maintain that you do a barbell approach, as I've done in a lot of my clients right now, meaning that we buy 1 to 2 years out, and then we buy almost the peak of the yield curve, especially municipal market, of about 10 years out. And therefore, we're kind of covered no matter what happens. Now, as the yield curve starts to flatten, which, of course, it's getting that point right now. I mean, here we have the 10-year treasury at 2.15 and the Fed funds rate at 1.25, soon to be 1.5. That is signs of a flattening yield curve. And therefore, if that stays intact, you want to start moving out on the yield curve because the Fed's going to, as you say, maybe crash land that proverbial plane. And we all know what happens when they miss their marks.
So outside of that, let's go to different bonds. We know where sovereign bonds are right now. They're very low in Europe. They're relatively high here on U.S. sovereigns. What about the corporate market, Rob, and municipal bonds? Where do they stand? There was a period of time after the financial crisis, which is hard to believe that I've seen it in my lifetime, where actually tax-free bonds were yielding more than taxable treasuries. Where do we stand when it comes to, let's say, the muni market today?
The muni market's kind of interesting. For short term wise, it's still less than the equivalent treasury. However, on the long end, a AAA rated municipal is about equal with the 10-year treasury in that case. However, if you go to the investment grade municipal, you may get for 10 years 2.7, 2.8 in that neighborhood, good quality California bonds. As far as corporates, corporates is a different story. We're using our Bloomberg terminals to find hidden gems in the corporate market. So, for example, today, for example, we are looking at a one floating rate bond that's already in the float, and it's paying 4.875. When it adjusts next quarter at the beginning of July, it will be at 5% or slightly above 5%. And that's for an investment grade corporate bond that was now is going to adjust every quarter as the Fed moves. That's fantastic, Jim.
So, Rob, let's say that we're in this rate raising mode and one doesn't know how long this will last. A lot of it will depend on whether the economy holds up or it buckles under as rates rise. Because as the Fed begins to shrink its balance sheet and doesn't roll over its mortgage-backed bonds, we know eventually mortgage rates are going to go up. That could put a damper on housing. We know that the auto sector right now is declining. So eventually, at some point, and I don't know, and I guess nobody knows at this point, whether it's 2018 or 2019, and all of a sudden the Fed starts going in the opposite direction because the economy's in a recession. What would you do then? Would you unload your floater bonds? Because in other words, now the Fed is going to be lowering interest rates, which means those adjustable rate bonds will be going lower in interest rates, or would you lock in at that time to something longer term?
We'd do something longer term. We would be looking to move out of our floating rates and into a locked position on other corporates or other municipals for that matter. Right now, we do have municipals that are yielding somewhere in the neighborhood called weekly floaters of 77 to 80 basis points, and they adjust on a weekly basis. So that's better than a money market fund because these, of course, are double tax free if you're in a state of California. But here again, you've got to be sensitive to what the Federal Reserve is doing. And of course, here we are very sensitive to what the Federal Reserve is doing. And so when we see signs that the Fed's tightening is leaning towards a slowdown in the economy, we will be moving out of the floating rates and moving back into fixed rates.
Well, listen, Rob, as we close, if our listeners would like to contact you regarding putting together a bond portfolio, how could they do so, please?
Sure. They can give me a call at 888-486-3939 or contact me via email at rob@paplava.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
In-depth interview from people who monitor all aspects of the markets and the economy during the Financial Sense News Hour weekday show. Here's a brief clip from this week.
We wrote more than 160 pages in our Ingoldsby Trust report that we just published on June 1st. But what are the main points? I would say that our view and our assumption of last year was confirmed by market action. Last year, we said that the worst is over, that we're at the beginning of a new bull market in gold. And I think price action actually confirms that. We should not forget that last year, actually, gold was up in every major currency. So it's been a really positive 2016, and actually 2017 is starting also pretty well. So in dollar terms, we're up 8% at the moment. In euro terms, it's a bit less, it's 3%. But we're again in every major currency and also in emerging market currencies, gold is up. In terms of technicals, we're making higher lows, which is clearly positive. And sentiment is still pretty skeptical, I would say. So from my point of view, that's a great setup. I think, as I've said, we're in the early stages of a new bull market. And now the question is, when will this bull market pick up momentum?
So welcome back to the second part of the big picture here. Jim Poplava and John Lufter still sitting here. Couldn't get rid of us, see? It didn't work during the break. Okay, let's turn to oil. It was widely thought, too, that with the OPEC cuts that were announced last year, the oil markets would begin to stabilize by the middle of 2017. Now the IEA says, well, gee golly willikers, it may be 2018 before that happens. You know, Jim, this is almost beginning to sound like the Fed's forecast, which, as we know, never come true either.
Well, you know, in the last segment, John, you and I talked about the inflation trade and the role that oil has played with that inflation. And we need to discuss why the price of oil isn't cooperating with that trade. It isn't cooperating. It isn't going where the Saudis thought or hedge funds thought it was going. Instead of rising oil prices, we are now back into bear market territory. When you consider that oil prices have fallen 20% from their peak in the first week of this year. So, you know, let's begin with production cuts of 1.8 million, which OPEC, believe it or not, has been pretty compliant on in following through. And that was one of the main reasons that we saw the price of oil go from $26 a barrel to $55 a barrel this past January. But prior to the cuts being put in place, the one thing that they forgot to say is everybody was saying, okay, we're all going on a diet, but let's like feast before we did. So when they announced the production cuts last November, they pushed the limit of production to record levels. So they pushed a lot of oil out into the system that ended up going into inventory because it was way more than what the oil markets could absorb. So in essence, they sort of flooded the markets before they said they were going to cut back. And that was why after January, oil prices peaked and you saw them start to work their way down towards 50 and then the upper 40s. And now they're in the lower 40s where they are today.
Jim, as we're looking at the oil prices, is this actually just an issue of U.S. oil shale thwarting everything that OPEC was trying to do?
Well, I mean, that is one reason, John, but there's probably five factors in total that have all converged to bring the price of oil down. I mean, let's begin with shale oil, which is the one that people talk about the most. Rising oil prices as they rose last year from 26 all the way up to 55 revitalized oil shale production here in the U.S. The latest rig count, we are up 431 drilling rigs since drilling rigs bottomed May 27th of last year. We are now up to 747. What does that mean? Every one of those oil rigs is producing oil. And so that has pushed U.S. production. U.S. production 2 weeks ago was clocked in at 9,350,000 barrels a day. Production alone is up almost 650,000 barrels in 27 alone. So if you take, for example, the cut in OPEC of 1.8 and subtract out of that close to 700,000 barrels of U.S., you're down to 1.1 million barrels alone that have absorbed a lot of that. And then there are other things that have come into play too. The second reason is it hasn't been just U.S. shale. Two countries that were left out of the oil production cuts were Libya and Nigeria, both of them going through political turmoil at the time. Well, if you take a look at Libyan oil production, is up to 900,000 barrels a day. That is up three times where it was a year ago. So add another 600,000 barrels of oil coming online from Libya. And then you have to go to Nigeria. Nigeria was below a million barrels a day because of political problems that they were having with terrorists and, you know, stealing from production lines and blowing up production lines. Now Nigeria is back up to 1.6 million. So if you take Libya, Nigeria, in U.S. shale, John, that's pretty much a good portion of almost 80% of OPEC's production cuts. So it's no wonder why you have not seen these inventory levels actually drop a lot faster. And that's what the markets were anticipating, because when OPEC announced, hey, we're going to cut 1.8 million barrels a day. I mean, that's a significant amount of oil production. And that was why we saw the price of oil go up to $55 a barrel. But if you take a look at where we are now, take 700,000 from US, take another 600,000 from Libya, take another 600,000-700,000 from Nigeria, and pretty much you can see where a lot of that production cut was made up. So that's the real question that OPEC has got to assess, given this, and given the fact that you've got other countries on board that are producing more oil, will OPEC production cuts really bring this down? In my opinion, it's going to take time to do this in economic growth, because we're consuming more oil each year, or it's going to have to be something dramatic, not just 1.8 million barrels. It's going to have to be something like 2.5 to 3 million barrels. In other words, another million barrel cut from where they are today. And most of that's going to have to come from Saudi Arabia.
And, you know, it's not just a U.S. event. Some of the members of OPEC were not included in the deal. And you add all of this up, and it adds up to what we're seeing in oil cuts.
Yeah, it's why inventory levels have not played as rapidly as, let's say, the markets were anticipating. There was a lot of speculation going into the OPEC meeting last November. You saw the hedge funds move in heavily and buying futures and going long oil. And then all of a sudden, when those inventory levels didn't start to come down, then all of a sudden, some of those bets were unwound. But basically, as we just talked about, most of those production cuts have been replaced by increased production elsewhere. So it is going to take longer to rebalance. Now, one thing the oil markets have not been paying attention to, and there's two ways that we can correct this, and that is inventory levels have fallen in the U.S. for 10 out of the last 11 weeks. We're down from 530 million barrels in inventory down to 510. Now, it may not sound like much, 20 million barrels, but it's more important what is the trend, because things happen at the margin. And at the margin, our inventory levels are starting to come down. Now, it can happen. One way would be for Saudi Arabia to export less to the United States, just cut back their exports, which means the United States could then fall back on its inventories and deplete those inventories, because U.S. inventories are kind of the key metric or benchmark that the oil markets watch, because it's so closely followed and it could be validated versus, let's say, elsewhere where inventory levels are really not tracked. You don't know what OPEC inventory levels are. So rebalancing is working, but John, it's just not working as fast as expected.
Well, there is talk out there of OPEC extending its cuts into next year. And what if they cut another deal? Could that do it?
First of all, it took time to get a deal, and that deal wasn't enough, because it's not enough to offset. I think OPEC was taken by surprise in terms of the damage they thought was going to be inflicted on American shale producers. And that damage was not as great as they thought. And because of technology, the cost of making a profit in shale has dropped nearly in half as a result of technology, hydraulic fracking, horizontal drilling. There are a lot of things that the U.S. technology companies have been able to do to bring down the cost of drilling a shale well. So it was sort of like a miscalculation, because they thought if they did this, well, they made two miscalculations. Number one, when they decided to increase production all out in 2014, which dropped the price of oil from $100 a barrel all the way down to 26, they really thought they'd kind of wipe out the shale industry. And actually, it didn't happen. Now, there were a lot of companies that went under. We'll talk about that in a minute. But technology, a lot of these companies were able to bring down that cost dramatically. And so they were able to survive and continue to produce. The second miscalculation they made was they thought, okay, 2 million barrels or 1.8 million, which is what the agreement was, and they're compliant in that, just wasn't enough. They didn't realize in a market-driven economy like the U.S. is how productive U.S. energy companies are. That was one. And the second one was political unrest settling down and becoming more peace-driven, that these production levels would get ramped up very easily, not only in Libya, but also in Nigeria. Same thing that happened in Iraq during the war, because Iraqi oil production is approaching 4 million barrels. So a lot of these OPEC producers that have been remained dormant or have held back or have had their production cut as a result of a political unrest, once that unrest goes away and peace returns to the region, they ramp up very quickly. And that's something that was a miscalculation they didn't take into consideration. And so right now, the marginal producer in the world is no longer OPEC or Saudi Arabia. It belongs to the U.S., which is raising, a lot of analysts are raising questions, has OPEC indeed lost control over the oil markets?
Are there any other factors that come in here? I mean, besides outside production, U.S. shale, and maybe just pure miscalculations. There just wasn't enough of a cutback.
Number one, their first miscalculation is they thought what they were going to do to American shale producers. So they kept producing all out for a long period of time. So what does that do? It means that we've built up these huge inventories, whether on tankers or in storage places. So the stockpiles have become rather significant. And the other thing that I was surprised to learn in doing a little bit more research, believe it or not, the U.S., when oil prices were at $50 and $50 upper 40s, the U.S. has been selling off oil out of the strategic petroleum reserves. We've sold 40 million barrels of oil. So the other thing that we're starting to see now in the latest reports is that oil is starting to be stored on tankers again. So the U.S. needs, there's a couple things we could do. The U.S. needs to, number one, export more oil, which means it would go less into inventory and we'd draw those inventories down a lot faster. Secondly, Saudi Arabia could cut back dramatically its exports to the U.S., which would also drive down inventory levels. So there's a number of couple things that they can do, and they're just going to have to think about this, because the unfortunate thing is a cartel is losing control in its ability to control the price of its commodity, because the U.S. is not a cartel. We're not part of the cartel. OPEC can't say to U.S. shale producers, hey, why don't you join the cartel? Because the U.S. government would never let that happen to begin with. But the U.S. is market-driven. You drive the price of oil up, what do you think the oil companies are going to do? They respond. They start bringing in more drilling rigs. They drill for oil, and they start producing more, which is exactly what has happened. Then I would probably say one final factor I think we have to look at here is the speculation in the oil market itself. And that comes mainly in the futures market with hedge funds. There's been a lot of activity. There were a lot of rise in long positions prior to OPEC's meeting in November on the anticipation that the cuts would be major and would cause prices to rise, which they did. But then all of this surplus inventory, and when U.S. production started coming on stream and it started announcing that inventories were continuing to build, that U.S. production was beginning to build, that more rigs were being added, that started to turn the speculative bets in the opposite direction. And so those bets were reversed. They began to rise again ahead of the OPEC meeting that basically extended those cuts for the balance of the year and then into the first quarter of next year. But then again, inventories aren't going down as much as we said, as we talked about. We've only seen a drop of about 20 million barrels in U.S. inventory, even though they've been dropping every week. And that's the trend. It isn't happening fast enough or in large enough quantities to reverse the trade.
It seems to be a truism that both governments and cartels, and sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between them, don't understand the powerful forces of a free market. Because when, you know, we had this case where the price of oil would rise and then U.S. energy companies respond to that rise, and then technology make those companies more fit. It's an adjustment. It's almost like the equivalent of non-static world accounting, Jim. You know that? You know, when politicians pass bills about taxes, they assume everything's going to be static. You raise the tax rate and then the revenue gets greater. That's not how it works. And it's not that way when the free market deals in the oil market either.
No. In fact, as a result of dropping oil prices, the energy industry got more efficient. They've almost brought down the cost of making a profit in shale oil in half. It used to be $80, $85. Now, a lot of the shale companies are saying $50. They can do well. And there are many that are real efficient that are saying that they can make money at $40 oil. And what you're going to see now, and we'll talk about, is you're going to see the big boys move into this field because, you know, here's the thing that's happened. Since 2015, there have been 105 oil producers that have gone under and 120 oil service companies. And, you know, I think OPEC was thinking that the damage would be a lot more severe. A lot of that had to do with the capital markets here and the way they function. A lot of these companies were kept alive with extension of bank loans and the extension of credit. But here's the big thing that you're starting to see now, and this could be another changing factor. Big oil is now moving into shale where they think they can make a profit because they have the technology and, more importantly, they have the capital wherewithal. They have deep, deep pockets. And if you take a look at what's happening with the big companies, the Exxons, the Shells, the Chevrons, a lot of these companies were spending big bucks on these big long-term projects, whether it was oil platforms drilling for oil in the Gulf of Mexico or the Arctic, which were very expensive. You're talking about multi-billion dollar projects. You go into a shale oil, you poke a hole in the ground and, you know, you get your payback in your first couple of years. So big oil is now moving into the shale regions, and they're also moving a very big, making big commitments into the Permian Basin, which is probably one of the most profitable regions for shale oil in the United States. In fact, most of the rig counts that you've seen over the last 12 months, most of them have gone into the Permian Basin region. So if you look at big oil, they're moving, they have the expertise, but more importantly, they have something these smaller companies don't have, which are deep pockets. Just to give you an example, the 30 shale oil companies, I'm talking about the 30, not the big guys, the 30 big shale producers lost collectively $130 billion over the last 2 years. Now, that is a big chunk of money, where the big guys, they can go in here, they think they can buy property better, they have better capital cost, their cost of financing is lower. They have the expertise, technological innovations that they have, they can employ as well. And big oil thinks they can go into shale and make profits at $40 oil. So that's another big sea change that's coming to shale oil.
And one of the transformations we've seen in the early stages of shale, you know, it favored the small tech companies, but now as things are changing, the full scale, low cost capital firms, those are the big boys. They're becoming involved, and the whole picture is changing again. But anyway, since the direction of oil is, what do we call it, iffy at best, you know, maybe we'll see it float above 50 or we'll just see it hang down around 40. What should investors do? How does this impact?
As you look at this right now, because oil can go in either direction, the safest way, if you're going to be in this sector, is to play with the big companies. First of all, they have the capital. They've proven that they've weathered the storm during the downturn. All these big companies, I don't care if you look at Exxon, Chevron, Total, Royal Dutch, all of them maintained their dividend. They protected those dividends because that was a big question that we really were asking at the end of 2015 and especially 2016. Last year, when we got down to $26 oil, the big question on the street was, who's first to cut their dividends? Well, that never happened. And shale is less expensive than these mega projects with a faster payback. So it goes to the bottom line, fast payback, less money up forward. And not only that, these are the companies that have low PEs and high dividend yields. So if you're waiting for the stock price to go up, at least you've got a dividend yield in between.
Well, right now, this seems to be, Jim, a big conundrum because oil could be a factor in the reflation trade, as we talked about in the first segment of the big picture today, or we may just be stuck with lower oil prices. Woohoo! You know, if you're going on a trip, that's good for consumers and for the big guys, but not for Vladimir Putin. Because Russia depends upon its oil income. Anyway, what are we doing in the weeks to come here on the program?
Well, the weeks to come, the first quarter is going to end, so we're going to be talking about corporate earnings here over the next 4 weeks. We have a Fed FOMC meeting coming up in July, but I don't think anybody expects anything to happen there. Maybe more clarification and see if they stick with this unwinding their balance sheet. But also, I think, John, we're going to be watching those LAIs and see what happens if this economy begins to soften, as we're seeing in the credit markets and as the bond market is signaling, and that could be a whole new ball game. And of course, we will have our eyes on Washington, where the healthcare bill has just made it out for discussion out of the Senate. So we'll see if this inertia in Washington continues, or they actually get something done and they start passing. Because I think once they get, if they can get healthcare done, they will move very rapidly on taxes. And then the easiest thing for them to do will be infrastructure. So a lot of stuff that we're going to be watching during the summer months. It may be slow times for the market, but there's a lot of stuff happening underneath the surface, and we'll be watching it here for you. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.